This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Anita Rao. Drive-through testing in parking lots, dwindling safety equipment, and unusually high anxiety are all in a day's work right now for many of those on the front lines of the coronavirus pandemic. COVID-19 cases are on the rise in North Carolina and now touch the lives of healthcare providers from the mountains to the coast. Today, we will hear from medical professionals across the state about what life is like on the ground in the fight against COVID-19. We go first to talk with Audrey Snyder. She's the Associate Dean for Interactive Learning and Innovation at the UNC Greensboro School of Nursing. Audrey, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So you are in touch with nursing students, and you have been having a lot of conversations with them throughout this period. And right at the beginning, there were a lot of people reaching out to you saying that they were really confused about how to deal with COVID-19. They weren't sure what information to follow. Tell me a bit about what you were hearing as this all began.
So I think that the slow response in the United States as far as dissemination of information to healthcare providers became really confusing, and different institutions were implementing different policies. And it's been difficult for our nurses who are in graduate programs with us, who are practicing on the front line, to hear conflicting information regarding when they should wear a mask, when they should not. And what's been difficult for them has been, as the supply chain has been impaired, that the lack of supplies has driven the policies. For example, one student saying that they've been told that until a patient tests positive, they don't need to wear a mask while interacting or caring for that patient. And we know that with this airborne virus, that nurses and other healthcare professionals do need to be wearing masks with anyone who's suspected to potentially have the virus.
So tell me about how working in this kind of situation is different from what most nurses are trained to do on a daily basis and the kind of information they're usually equipped with before they are going in and working with patients.
So nurses receive standardized training in the facility that they work in and the type of population that they work with. They get specialized training for their populations. One of the challenges that's occurring, not yet here in North Carolina, but in some of the other states, is the fact that hospitals are not doing routine procedures so that they can save supplies to be used with potential COVID-19 patients. And with that, it means that there are nurses who may have never worked in critical care or worked with a ventilator who are now being reassigned to COVID-19 units. And that means they need to have information to be able to care for those patients. And just-in-time training may not be enough for some of them to do that. A previous student told me that their facility was gearing up this week with 3 days of training for nurses who've never worked in ICU to get them oriented to the ICU environment. The American Association of Critical Care Nurses has put out some just-in-time training that's online specifically to the virus and specifically to respiratory management and ventilator management for those who may not have experience. And it can be for any nurse. They do not have to be a member of that organization in order to partake of that information that's being disseminated.
That's interesting. So you're pointing out, obviously, nurses that are trained to work in a critical care environment or maybe even in a disaster situation have a different level of training and preparedness than someone who is maybe kind of working on a day-to-day basis with less, critical care patients. So I wonder for you, as you're kind of going through and trying to assess the needs of these students, you created this video, this 18-minute video, trying to both give information about the virus, how it's transmitted, how to care for patients. What were the main gaps that you were really hoping to fill as you provided this information?
So part of the gap was to really stress the importance of this being a virus that had not been seen in our lifetime before, that this was a opportunity for our students to know the key questions for screening, because as they're entering the workforce or are already in the workforce, regardless of what type of environment they're in, they'll be seen as a healthcare professional and needing to know what screening questions people should be asked, to also know what equipment they should be wearing in working with these patients, and to understand what we know currently about the virus and the fact that there's not a treatment. that everything is supportive at the moment. There are some compassionate care uses of certain medications, but that this is a new situation for all of us, and the importance of them staying in touch as they're in their clinical arenas with their preceptors and learning the information that is there. Now, I will say that because Greensboro now is only essential travel, that our students are not in their clinical arenas as of yesterday evening. So we have told our students to not increase the travel, not increase the risk of transmission of the virus.
Okay, I want to play a voicemail now. We've reached out to people, healthcare workers on the front lines all around the state, and I want to take a listen to a clip we got from someone who works at the Wake Forest Baptist Medical Center.
My name is Dennis Taylor. I am an acute care nurse practitioner, and I work at Wake Forest Baptist Health in Winston-Salem. For my population of trauma patients, those patients are coming in, and we really have no idea in terms of we don't have an opportunity to screen them the way we do other folks that may be coming in through the emergency department. So for all of those patients, we are just making the assumption that they have had some exposure to it. So every time they come in, and it's a scary thing for the patients to come in and see a room full of people that you can't see their face. All you can see is maybe their eyes. But, someone wearing head protection, eyes, a face mask, and you really can't see, I think for the patients, that becomes a very scary thing.
That's Dennis Taylor, an acute care nurse practitioner at Wake Forest Baptist Medical Center. And we want to hear from you, no matter how this crisis is affecting you, what your job is, what you're doing now. Please reach out to us and let us know how you're doing. Leave us a text or a voicemail at 919-980-5419. I'm here now with Audrey Snyder from the UNC Greensboro School of Nursing. So this clip brings up a really interesting question, I think, Audrey, of, healthcare providers who are at this interesting moment where they're trying to mitigate risk while also making sure that patients don't panic, going in and being fearful and hearing all of the fear in the community and then, barely being able to see your healthcare provider's face. What are the challenges there for providers in navigating that tension?
So it's definitely a challenge. And I think many times in a situation, as he described, the person who's at the head of that patient's bed, it's going to be important that they're talking consistently to the patient and reassuring them about what they're doing, explaining who people are in the room so that they can understand a little bit better about what's happening around them. At the same time, we know that many healthcare institutions have had to institute policies where that there's not visitors, and that can be very stressful for the family as well as the patient who's being cared for.
I want to bring in another guest to the conversation now. Dr. Mike Waldrum is joining us. He's the CEO of Vidant Health, which serves 29 counties in eastern North Carolina, including some of the most poverty-stricken parts of the state. Dr. Waldrum, welcome to the State of Things.
Thank you for having me.
You recently penned an op-ed asking state and local governments to step up their response to this crisis. Talk about your concerns and the measures you're requesting.
Well, I believe that really all of the dialogue that you've had so far on the show today is why we were making that statement. And the most important thing is to be proactive. And I think, as was stated, I agree wholeheartedly with Dr. Snyder's comments. And, we've never been here before, but we do know how epidemics happen, and we do know the characteristics of epidemics and this virus specifically from how it affected other communities in other countries and then other communities in the United States. And so we know how it infects people and how to decrease the rate of infection. And so the way to do that is to act aggressively early and to prevent the spread of the virus, because if it affects more people in the population, obviously that's a bad thing, but it leads to all of the stress in the delivery system to provide excellent care And so it's really, it all goes. So how do you stop the wave, or, you know, what we call flatten the curve, stop it as quickly as you can?
I want to pause you there for a second. We only have about a minute, but what I'd like you to help us understand is, for those of us who are not in the healthcare system, when we hear statistics like, you know, on average, hospitals around the state are already at 80 to 90% capacity this time of year before a pandemic like this. So help us understand why that is, and then, you know, what it would take for your hospitals to kind of handle this worst case scenario.
Well, the two major problems that we have as a baseline in healthcare in the United States and in North Carolina is we have a broken supply chain. So we struggle with giving our professionals adequate supplies to deal with the issues that they face every day before the pandemic. Primarily pharmaceuticals is the most common one. And then in the United States and most countries, we are not built or funded to create surge capacity, which means having extra beds or staff ready to deploy if you see a massive increase in demand for services.
All right. I'm going to come back and ask you to talk about how your hospital is preparing for a potential surge in a moment. Dr. Mike Waldrum and Audrey Snyder are both my guests now. We'll be back with more voices from the front lines of North Carolina's healthcare system as we continue our conversation on the state of things from North Carolina Public Radio. It's a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Anita Rao. While North Carolina politicians ponder their role in responding to the coronavirus, healthcare workers know they will be the first responders no matter what. Workers on the front lines are already putting in overtime in preparation for a surge, and in rural areas, closed hospitals and limitations in telehealth may prove to be weak links as the virus spreads beyond urban centers. Across the state, all healthcare workers, including those outside hospitals, are feeling the virus impact their work and their personal lives.
On FaceTime, my granddaughter, she told me to make sure that I washed my hands and sang happy birthday, and that she certainly missed seeing me. You know, that's probably the thing that has impacted me the most while I live nearby my family, not being able to really interact with them the same way that I've always been able to.
That was Dennis Taylor, an acute care nurse practitioner at Wake Forest Baptist Medical Center. Today, we are listening to what those in the healthcare system have to say. I'm talking with Dr. Mike Waldrum. He's the CEO of Vidant Health, serving Eastern North Carolina. Also still with us is Audrey Snyder, an associate dean at the UNC Greensboro School of Nursing. So, Dr. Snyder, I want to go back to you to talk about this surge. I know that Vidant announced in early March that it would be cutting nearly 200 staff members. So how are you ensuring that you're going to have enough people present to handle a potential surge if it comes your way?
So I believe that was for me, Dr. Waldrum. So those were not clinical personnel. And so the way we've been, one, I would like to say I'm really empathetic to that voicemail, personally living through exactly the same thing with my family. And then two, building the surge, you know, has to do with building capacity and understanding the surge of what you need to meet the surge. And so we know what this is. We know what this virus does and how it spreads. And so you can predict what is needed. So we've been working for three, four weeks on understanding that and then what we need to have in place and deploying the right assets to be able to meet that demand. And so one is understanding that. Two is decreasing what that surge may be. And so we've been very active, as you mentioned earlier, in Pitt County. We're so proud of Pitt County and Greenville being the first county to pass regulations to decrease public gatherings and to decrease the surge. And so we want to do everything we can to prevent people from acutely needing inpatient demand. And so building systems, virtual care, and those kind of things and connections to the ambulatory environment and understanding those patients and then being able to navigate them to the inpatient environment as they may need. And then building the capacity from an inpatient perspective. The biggest issues in building that capacity actually are a national problem and state problem with good testing and rapid testing to know what you're treating. And so, as we heard earlier in that very poignant voicemail that you had about the trauma, is that right now in many organizations and in many places, you assume everybody has it. And so you're consuming resources on the majority of people that don't have the problem. And so we've been fortunate to bring on what is called rapid testing. We can test people and get a result within hours. And in some institutions, actually the majority of institutions across the state, it is sometimes days, 4 or 5 days before you know if that patient has the virus. And
I want to pause you there for a second and turn to Audrey. Audrey, I know we're talking about a potential surge and trying to prepare for it. And obviously, every healthcare system is doing their best to make sure they have the staff that they need. But there is a nursing shortage, at least in our state right now. A number of factors contributing to this. So how does that factor into this moment? Nurses who are kind of at the front lines, and maybe there aren't as many there that we need to take care of patients.
So as nurses who are at the front lines have the potential to become ill with COVID-19, they will be out of the workforce. And we can see that number of need increasing. In the rural areas, that's even greater because there's a smaller workforce in the rural area to begin with. And then if you have one or two nurses at a critical access hospital who become ill, then they will not be able to meet the needs of that community as well.
Mike, how are you managing risk and preparing Vidan employees for the danger of falling ill?
Yeah, I think it's a great question. I would globalize this issue to all providers. And so if we have physician shortages primarily in rural communities, as well as nurses and other. And I think capacity building is going to be an issue with the workforce as the major limiting factor for capacity and preparing for the surge. And so these other things are important in being able to do that, like knowing and being able to test so you can protect your workforce is vital to the intervention. The other one is we've changed models of care, so only a very select group of people will be entering certain positive patient rooms. So in the last few weeks, we have been training and redeploying the model of care, and so to protect our people.
What does that look like specifically?
Well, specifically, it's cohorting patients into units. So if you can test and you know that you have them, you can isolate them quickly. Having very few people enter the room to provide the care that are given equipment that is very high end to protect them, with the assets outside of the room to take care of them. For instance, we don't want nurses to enter a room to change an IV pole when we can just put extension on that IV pole out into the hallway and they can change the infusion, for instance, outside the hallway. And so it's things like that. So the mix of people that are in the room versus outside of the room, and having more of a monitoring function of certain professionals outside the room with special equipped people inside the room.
All right, I want to bring in one more guest to our conversation now. We are talking today about how COVID-19 is changing the lives and the experiences of healthcare workers all around the state. I'm going to share a quick story from another nurse who gave us a ring about her experience in this moment.
Hi, my name is Jennifer. I'm up in Caswell County in the north part of the state. I am a retired registered nurse, and so I am spending my day experimenting. I have cut up some old scrub gowns that I kept after I retired, and I am making reusable face masks out of them. I'm going to take a prototype over to Annie Penn Hospital in Reidsville, and I'm also sending one up to Delaware to my niece, who is currently an RN in the operating room. So that's how I'm spending my day, and I'm over 70, so I am isolating.
That's Jennifer, a retired nurse from Caswell County. I'm here with Dr. Mike Walderman, Audrey Snyder. So Audrey, there are a number of people that are making homemade masks, you know, trying to help with the shortages that we've heard about. I know there are some health concerns with some of these at-home masks. Tell us about what folks at home can do to help those on the front lines.
The most important thing is stay home. I know a lot of people think that this is something that's going to be resolved quickly, and it can be resolved in a shorter term period if we can keep people at home. The fact that the virus is transmitted prior to someone knowing that they actually have it means that someone going out and doing their daily activities could transmit it to multiple people that they come in contact with, or if the virus sheds in droplets and lands on a surface and another person touches that surface and then they touch their face, their mouth, and they inhale the virus and then they become ill. And so even though a person is saying, I feel really great, I am fine, I think it's fine for me to go out and do routine things, they really need to stay home. That's the number one thing they could do to help the rest of us. It's great that there are people making masks. My hope is that the stockpiles come in that have been promised. It's going to take a while for those to be made. These homemade masks are similar to what were worn in the 50s and 60s in the surgical areas, but usually in a surgical area, you were not dealing with a virus. It was to try and prevent anything from the providers going to the patient. And this is a little bit different. We're trying to prevent that virus from being inhaled by the providers who are taking care of the patients. There are some studies that show they're about 80% effective, 80 to 83%, depending on which one you look at. So if that helps people feel better by being able to make them and provide them, the other people who may be able to use them are those persons who are immunocompromised. So your patients who may have being treated for a cancer or who have other autoimmune diseases, they may be able to wear them so that they can still get the treatments that they need if a facility is completely out of masks to be able to provide to those patients.
All right, Dr. Mike Waldrum, the CEO of Vidant Health, and Audrey Snyder, Associate Dean for Experiential Learning and Innovation at the UNC Greensboro School of Nursing. Thank you so much to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
And just a reminder, we really want to hear from you about how COVID-19 is changing your life. Please call and leave us a voicemail with your stories, 919-980-5419. I'd like to turn now to a healthcare worker in Western North Carolina. She has some concerns about privacy on the job as a healthcare professional, so we're just going to call her by her first name today. Darlene is a family nurse working in palliative care. Hey, Darlene.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Tell us about how you're adjusting to your work. You usually do house calls with elderly patients. You've moved a lot of that to telemedicine. Tell me about that transition.
Yes. Well, prior to this happening, we did a lot of phone calling and non-face-to-face time with clinicians and, in collaboration, because palliative care is a specialty and is, always considered to be collaborative with primary care and other specialists, and also with family members and caregivers. A lot of our patients have cognitive or other serious illness that impairs them in terms of being able to interact directly with clinicians. So I've been, in a sense, I've been fortunate in that I can do a version of telemedicine, especially because the guidelines were listed on what we can bill for. I can't say that I'm perfect at documentation, and also my organization, which I think is doing an excellent job of caring for patients and also for us employees.
It's a lot to keep track of taking care of your own health, right, while dealing with patients who are uncertain about how this may be affecting them. I know that you yourself are immunocompromised. So how have you worked to keep yourself safe while also providing consistent care to the people that you provide care for?
Right. Well, I was going to say, from my perspective as a house call, mainly house call and facility visiting clinician, with immunocompromised myself, I feel lucky to be able to be working from home, mostly doing telephone calling for patients. I haven't had a video chat with anyone yet, but I'm trying to get some of my folks to do that. But the patients, to me, are the ones that are on the front lines as well. I mean, healthcare workers, too. I have family in New York who are exposed and quarantined and expecting to have to go back to inpatient, and it's very scary up there. And I worry about my patients who are at home and who are dealing with chronic multiple serious illnesses. And because of the lack of information, because it's a novel virus, and also because leadership on it and communication about it has been, you know, something that we've all struggled with. I had a patient I had to talk to on the phone and counsel about, you know, she needs dialysis to survive, and she was really scared to go. And so we talked about the basics of herself washing her hands and not touching her face, and herself having a mask so that when she's there, you know, she can be treated without feeling unsafe and without being unsafe.
Yeah.
And then checking in again. But really, I feel, you know, most concerned for my coworkers and some of my friends in other realms who have been waiting for these delayed tests to come back, who are going into long-term care facilities, who don't always have their right PPE. But I also see some hope on the horizon. I believe in Italy and even in New York right now, they're seeing somewhat of an effect of the isolation or the distancing actually helping.
Well, Darlene, thank you so much for sharing your story with us. Darlene is a family nurse in Western North Carolina. Thanks, Darlene.
Thank you.
Social media and news reports are heaping praise on nurses and other healthcare workers in the middle of this global pandemic, but as they deal with longer hours and more stressful situations, who is advocating for their rights? Nurses at two hospitals in Western North Carolina are trying to unionize, and COVID-19 is slowing down the process. Frank Taylor is the managing editor for Carolina Public Press, and he joins me now to share their reporting on the story. Welcome back, Frank.
Thank you.
Tell me about why nurses at these two hospitals want to unionize.
The bottom line, they said, is they're concerned about working conditions. And this came up before the COVID-19 crisis really went into high gear. The process began right at the beginning of March.
And how has the pandemic altered the timeline of their efforts?
Well, the company has petitioned the National Labor Relations Board to delay hearings, citing, we can't afford to have hearings and so forth during this crisis. And the nurses have pushed back and said, if that's true, why is the company scheduling what they're calling training sessions to give us anti-union propaganda during our shifts? The company said, yeah, we're doing that. We think it's an important investment, but really hasn't addressed how it balances with the company's alleged concerns about the staffing.
So HCA asked for a delay in the union meeting because of the coronavirus pandemic, but they were still pulling nurses into these meetings. And so there's growing tension between the nurses that are trying to organize and the hospital officials. How is that playing out kind of alongside trying to deliver care?
That's a good question. I don't think we know the answer yet. We're just kind of seeing the jostling in the filings that have been made with sworn statements back and forth. I know that the next hearing on the union issue was delayed from earlier, it would have been last week. It's been delayed to sometime in early April. And we may see additional delays, I suppose, as the crisis develops. We now have patients in Asheville where they're based, which we did not when some of those filings initially occurred.
So Mission Health has come under a lot of scrutiny since HCA Healthcare purchased the former nonprofit last year. This is kind of another tick in that story. Can you kind of broaden out and paint us a bigger picture of what's been going on and what the concerns are?
Sure. Well, the Attorney General's office, Josh Stein's office, has been looking into the situation with HCA's takeover. There have been a lot of allegations that Mission is not really holding up its end of the bargain under HCA and has had a decrease in some of the services that it was supposed to maintain at appropriate levels since that takeover. Mission has certainly pushed back on those claims, but the Attorney General says, I want answers to some specific complaints by the end of March. And all of the complaints in question really go to, you know, level of service, whether there is, in fact, consistency going on. And some of the complaints specifically describe nurses as really being stretched thin, as we've had public hearings where patients have come in and said, this is what I saw when I went there. And I saw, even though they were working hard, even though they cared about patients, they're overwhelmed. And this was back at the beginning of February, before the crisis took place.
So these nurses are saying we're overwhelmed, we're understaffed, we're stretched thin, all of this happening amidst this big major crisis. So what's the next step? How has the timeline altered at this point? What are we looking forward to?
Well, we should see a hearing unless it alters further. We should see a hearing, I think it's around April 6th, and we'll see how it progresses. In the meantime, Mission is continuing to have sessions with nurses, encouraging them to oppose unionization, telling them that they'll face dues that they don't want to have to pay, and they'll lose rights by voting for the union. And, of course, those backing the union, including a lot of our local politicians, both at the city and county level, are generally encouraging nurses to consider the union effort.
Frank Taylor is a managing editor of Carolina Public Press. Frank, thank you so much.
No problem.
You can find links to all of their reporting at our website, stateofthings.org. And we are going to keep following the story and continue to check in with the stories of healthcare workers. And we want to hear from you. Please call us and leave us a voicemail, 919-980-5419. You can also send a text to that same number. We would love to hear from you.